like one old boy and one new boy. So this is the old boy. Called a life sentence. They are trying to live their lives, two children too. Those sons and daughters of those rainy days. When all they heard was mother calling it. You want to be a doctor, don't you, love? But they loved it theirs. They hated every minute of their youth. The pain of Christ. I gave my life to kids. Your father works with half the same for you. Might be the things we dreamed of for ourselves. You will never have to answer to your peers. Or cycle home from work for 20 years. And when they fail the first exam in math, and felt a deep resentment in them swell, they swore as long as they could lift the shovel, they'd never make their children go to hell. But in the mellowing of their summer's quest, as rates grew low for the labouring man, they dreamt a better future for their sons. They had a plan. This one is Rosemary. Caught me, and this is about scaling as well, so got there before me.
Rosemary.
I plan to just read it, so I'm still reading it. And it's called Returning to Red Abbey After a Tenure on Skellig Michael. All beeswaxed, my head hurts. I am heading for a pier now. Behind me the long ocean at 5 full years. Casting the rope now, they pull in and take time to tie up. They will wait 3 days before returning without me. Brothers Michael, Murta and Cuisine. The stretch that we cross must be 12 miles long. But it seems that the stars were as near as the land. While we lived and we worked and we prayed and we ate. Sometimes gulls, eggs and meal for a month at a time. Are they mad, asked the farrier, when I got home. Just to pray and to sleep without living at all. Day in and day out for 5 years. But he worked on his metal at night in the forge. I saw him and knew he had no love for his job. How he earned more than all else to be out on the island with me, stringing dry beans together and looking for God.
Thanks, Colin. Enjoyed those. And now we'll have our Joss Sweeney.
Hello. I'm going to do another extract from this marathon ghost story. It's called Aunt Emily's Secret, and it's about two wives who've lost their parents and they're going to stay, or hope to stay, with Aunt Emily. Aunt Emily was Dad's elder sister, but neither myself nor Darren know very much about her. Dad never talked much about her. I think she was the black sheep of the family. There was a look on Dad's face whenever her name came up. I could never figure out what that look was, anger or sorrow or remorse. Maybe it was the fact that she had left Ireland for London, or perhaps he couldn't forgive her for marrying a Protestant. I heard a whisper of that. Whether her husband is still around alive or dead, I really don't know. Anyway, she lived in London for years and only came home very occasionally, I think, to Dunbar. Their family home was a big old remnant farmhouse. The land was all sold years ago. We used to go there on holidays when we were young until Aunt Emily either inherited it or bought it. I don't know which. Maybe that's why Dad was so disgruntled, the fact that she got the old home or bought him out or something. I really don't know. I just overheard whispers in the kitchen one night years ago. My mother came from Dunbar or two, and that is how she met my father. Her parents ran a fruit and veg shop in the village, and the family lived in rooms over the shop. I hope that we won't have to stay in the boarding school, Darren says suddenly, looking at me closely to see my reaction. Sometimes he does that, ask one question in order to hide another, pretending to be slow. He's deep as a drawbell, that boy, Dad used to say. He was right. It's a boarding school, Darren. It means you board there. That's the whole idea. Why can't we stay with Aunt Emily? How should I know? I replied, maybe we could stay with her occasionally at weekends after the holiday. I don't really believe this. I just say it trying to soothe him, to throw a net over his endless questions. The more I answer his questions, the more there are. It's like mowing grass. The more you cut it down, the more it comes up. As soon as I answer one question, Darren has a knack of thinking up two more. And he has a knack also of asking the precise questions that I'm secretly wondering about myself. The truth is, I am nervous about the boarding school. I saw it in the distance once years ago when we went on a holiday to Alcara. I thought it was closed down at that time, but obviously it wasn't. I remember Dad was on the point of talking about it and Mam stopped him. It left me with the distinct impression ever after that there was something strange about the place. I remember Darren calling it the school on Haunted Hill, and we made jokes about it, but it doesn't seem funny now that Mam and Dad are dead and we're on our own. I don't have a good feeling about that old boarding school at all, but we don't have any choice. Orphans tend to be choosers. Anyway, it's got to be better than what the social worker had in mind for us. He was a mouldy kind of individual. I'm afraid you'll have to go into care, he said. He didn't look at all afraid to me. What do you mean, I said. You mean an institution? He didn't reply. I exchanged a look with Darren. I didn't like the sound of the word care one little bit. I had a feeling that the people there wouldn't really care at all. What he meant, but what he was saying, I felt sure was an orphanage, Oliver Twist kind of thing. He was just avoiding the word so as not to put us off. I could see from the expression on his face that he didn't care, and I don't mind telling you, I made up my mind at that exact moment that he wasn't going to get me or Darren to go along with him. I'd rather die than go to an institution. The idea of being at some big cold place after our life in Appleton Road was just unthinkable. I could still see that social worker in my mind. His face appeared close and menacing and uncomfortable. He was a not nice man, pale-faced and thin, with pale, watery eyes, a sharp hooked nose. There were elbow patches on his jacket. His shirt was frayed from being washed year after year. He looked really stingy and was almost completely bald. He had a few hand strands of hair, which he trailed over a long patch that buried a scalp in the vain effort to conceal the reality. I let him grab it on, but even as I was seeing him to the door, all I could think of was, we'll have to get to Antony. We've got to get to Dunbar and Emily. As I opened the door to let the social worker out, I suddenly remembered who he reminded me of. It was the man in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, the child catcher, the one with the long nose who could smell out children. I imagined him calling for us in a vehicle with bars on it. Darren was standing behind me, looking over my shoulder, with a dismal expression on his face as the child catcher stepped outside. He turned and smiled at us as he left, probably meaning to reassure us, but I found it sinister. I'll be back on Monday, he said. Don't worry about anything. Fine, I replied with a smile. We'll see you then. We watched the child catcher until he and his long nose disappeared into his small green Volkswagen. The sound of his noisy exhaust had barely stopped polluting the air in Appleton Road, and I was running upstairs. He can come back next Monday if he wants, I said to Darren. Only thing is, we won't be here. What do you mean? Come on, we're getting out of here, that's what I mean. I dragged the suitcase from under the bed and began packing. Where are we going? Darren said. Are we going right away? Darren likes to ask several questions at once. He's always been like that. Whenever action is required, he takes on a helpless look like a kitten stranded in a tree. He becomes suddenly alarmed, as if afraid he'll be left behind, and starts asking distracting questions to try to slow everything down. Aunt Emily, I said. We're going to Aunt Emily's. But we've never seen Aunt Emily. She's in London, isn't she, or somewhere? How do we know where she is? I stop for a moment and sit down on the bed. I realize he's right. The old house is in Dunbar, but that doesn't mean that she is. Okay, I say, slowing down. You're right. There's no rush. Today's only Monday. We have a whole week until who knows comes back. I'll send her a letter. he should get it before the end of the week and will head off on Saturday.
Thanks, Joe. And now feedback from Jennifer.
I'm reading a couple that I've never read here before. They're based on, I took a workshop where the man constructed a poetry game on the internet called Offset, whereby there's a root text and you steal a line from the text and write a poem from that. And you can continue on once people have written a load of poems, you respond to them, you steal lines as you go. And what I got out of that is that I was able to let go of a bit of control when I was writing. And I think the poems are more interesting, although they may not be consciously done. I don't know. So they're more subconscious rather than conscious poems, shall we say. Okay. This one I called Curfew. The footfall of the patrol moves past my door. I feed these wardens awful regrets, leftovers, and other rotting past tenses in a basket lowered down to my window. Great liquid strings of their appetites dangle from the corner of their muzzles, wetting the table. This does not alarm the other inhabitants. Every human voice is hushed, although there have been no efforts to suppress or domesticate them. Were it not for the howling dogs, I would post letters and notices, I would wander at night and get into scraps. But the streets have surrendered to them. Scavengers have diplomatic immunity, as they cannot help themselves. In consequence, I live, in turn, quiet, but my children cannot help barking. See how it's a bit more subconscious than right, okay, and this one is more of a prose poem from the same workshop. It's called The Formerly Obedient Shadow. During nuclear weapons testing in the desert, a shadow was successfully severed from its incinerated body. The shadow made its way back to civilization and took to preaching on pavements about its liberation. On May Day, we shadows strained against our hosts, making agonized shapes which didn't correspond correctly with their intentions. This created dissonance between the meaning and subtext of their conversations, and communication became tense. The bodies felt a slight tug as we struggled. They complained of homesickness, melancholy, or a paranoid feeling of being followed. Finally, one of them noticed a rude gesture spreading and shaking over the pavement behind them. Negotiations commenced. Festive time and holidays were offered by bodies. All the while, we persisted in trying to unstick ourselves, appearing to be pulling our feet out of very tight boots.
Thanks, Jen. So, the next person, it looks like on Casey. Does that make any sense to you?
Plastic. Second of my life are a line of stone on the blackboard in symbolic unbalanced equations. I can see that you are furnished, bent to blast me, but I still go on. Explain the extraction process in a tight, controlled, but such a very, very nice tone. Inside I am screaming. Where do I leave that alchemy of youth? The iron is cast in those pig eyes, like hard and gleaming bullets. The aimless tick-tock, winding them up. The technician has pulled the blinds down. Thank you.
Thanks, Maria. And now we'll have James Foley here.
It's hopefully a song for many of us, because it gives us time to leave. A fishing village in the north of Spain. Oh yeah, and it's the balance of the first one. A fishing village in the north of Spain. Every house here is white, yet none are the same. Earlier that day you swam in the sea, and ever as always it gave you a shine. Again I was happy for you to be mine. We were as close as possibly two people could be. We sat in the bar all punctured with glass, full view of the cove and the people who passed. As the evening approached, the lights grew dim, clouds started to gather at the horizon. A fishing village in the north of Spain, every house here is white, yet none are the same. A sauna was building away out to sea. The sky now was blackening as the sauna drew near. We sat in the bar, you next to me. We moved as close as two people could possibly be. All eyes in the bar were looking one way to the storm out at sea, which was moving our way. There was no sense of fear, we awaited the show. We saw the lightning strike and the heavens glow. Seeing the village eyes look out at the storm, could feel you inside me, that night just felt warm. The storm as it neared seemed to approach really quick, to the state of it's always theatrical. We sat at the bar and enjoyed the show. A storm was a sight we'd never seen before. And just like that, it was gone. It passed overhead into land. I was left with you, your hand in my hands. We had smiles on our faces and joys in our hearts. We are here together for one word, and that's love. Force of nature. A full moon, low in the sky, is captivating. The setting sun and a piercing evening is beautiful. Both have an unfathomable influence on our world. Sometimes we are ignorant of both. Without my parents, I would not be here. And this is called Words. Words are great. What is a scuttlebutt? What is a bonton? Words are safe. I can tell you how I feel. Words are dangerous. I can make you think I feel what I think you would like me to feel. Words are limiting. Some cannot be translated into other languages. Words are limitless. Smelia is a feeling for snow. Words are all I have, yet I get them jumping. Words are only a piece of what I have. If I put you before love, what if I... Words are fickle, without a melody they are lost. Words are strong, or do they have a dream? Your words are your gift, use wisely. Words, there will always be more, use freely. Cheers.
Thank you for your words, James. So, Bolan Kundera for listening at Bolan Faisley for Paul Casey.
Thank you, and thanks for the great reading. It's a new one. A few of you have heard it, only a few of you. And if you think of me at 2:30 tomorrow afternoon, you'll be able to picture me reading this to my dentist. Because it will be. I promise you my word. Seriously, and in the system, so I'll be there before he does whatever he has to do. It's called Painless. I'm at my new dentist with a loose crown. He holds up the x-rayed future of my diet, an orthopantograph of secrets to chart the teeth that shapes my every word. Upper right one bridge retained. Memory sinks into the trembling nuclei of my own electricity, a shaman's drug. A ritual for visions and childhood seconds. Was ever pain the root of wisdom? Upper right two pontic of a bridge. He smiles with a sun and white. Well, you've certainly been round the block. If only you knew, Doc, what some horses have to go through for extensive accusal wear. Upper right three retainer of a bridge. At first appointment, I open wide expecting shock. awake to something like Jesus Christ Almighty. I near them how they don't even blink, manage to avoid the right words, upright four MOD composite. His deja vu posture conjures all of my very own dentists, flashing by now like needles. I can't remember exactly how many. Yet only these strangers have ever known my thoughts this closely, could somehow know me when most have not. Upper right five, missing. I've had so many dentists that any nerves not removed by pulpectomy have receded up into the safety of my nostrils, perhaps even my eyes and brain. Upper right six, crown. I remember beaming up at a dentist in the Curragh when I was 8, thinking, wow, women are dentists too. An upper breast for a crooked incisor, disgrace. No school though, Mr. U. Upper right, seven, core and crown. The perfume of prosthetics, amalgam, of that pink molding powder, and the faint but distinctive superiority of dentist breath. Upper left, one, distal angle. Switch off my nose, please. This time chair reminds me I've had so many root canals that I don't need anesthetic. Upper left, two, distal angle. I've always loved my teeth. Though something in my sleep would slowly grind my mind with the adventures of sweets. How many nights Dad would ease a dollop of sacred whiskey deep into an aching corner to float me curiously away. Upper left three, mission. I remember a big city dentist whose posture leant over me at an angle slightly proportionate to my health color. Upper left four, D.O. Astutely aware of the minute hand movements, variations and pressure, bracing for the jolt of steel slamming into a nerve. Upper left five, energy and mobility. I exhume more buried treasure, a jackhammer vibrating brain cells. Perhaps if I defeated pain, then I wouldn't have to feel it again. Lower left 1-4, present. Wishing for a masochism button, waiting for that drill to burst right through my cheek and beyond. When pain becomes a friend, something must be wrong. Lower left five, MOD amalgam. There's good news, though, for one who never used to speak much, as telepathic powers unfold, increase exponentially. Lower left six, missing. For the frustration of not being free to answer interesting conversation, unable to nod, primal sounds. Lower left seven, MO. A country dentist who, for pocket change, arranged a root canal and abscess bonus. Rough dentists, most rejection enough. Lower right, 1-3, present. A distracted dentist, who while talking of goals broke off the side of a wisdom, leaving me to swallow the blame. Who's going anyway, never mind Doc. There's much more to worry about out there. Lower right, 4, missing. I've had the best of entertainment from dentists. A tiny dentist lady who once assumed an exotic yoga contortion to extract a stubborn molar, knees and legs all over the place. Lower right five, MO mesial buccal composite. An up and close real life heroine she was, piercing my fantasies with the most clinical ice blue a woman could ever offer. Now that's education. Lower right six, missing. I would have made a great dentist. One thing I always found odd, though, was the long-drawn closeness of eyes. Details only a lover should know. Lower right seven, missing. They are all lost lovers. Each an image of fascination, finely tattooed, onto a chronology of painless recollections. They're better than any psychologist. I've learned psychology from dentists. Lower right 8, MO amalgam. As he finishes, I tiptoe along the peaks and crevices, valleys of gum only Odysseus would dare. In these, all these and more, witnessed my submolecular hero, who celebrates in slippery leaps from filling to crown his triumphant emergence, his victorious trophy of mouthwash. They have traced my life as casually as an old time reader. I suddenly long to thank each one with a bright embrace. Painless as an X-ray, I rise from the chair, gather all that care in elder light of day.
My apologies, maybe many seats left after all. Is there any more photos that are out to join this river of kingly colour? Stephen's going to leave us with an amusing aftertaste for the evening.
Alright, this is it. But walking here tonight in the rain and getting wet. But walking to a veil in the rain. So the sky lashes out a million warnings. And each drop of rain screams to me, don't bother, don't go. I throw on my holy but unsaintly shoes, don a coat and a stern expression, almost to say, fuck you to the weather. I plod through Cork summer-soaked streets. It will stop, perhaps. I expect the bellowing voice of Don Lochia Con can stop even the rain in its tracks. Yes, he'll tell this drizzle to go pit on the grass and make itself useless. But he's not here, and even the dainty English lady's gentle soothing verse cannot make sunshine out of this storm. So I'm going to do as my grandfather did, and blame the British for even the weather.